He was drowsing over his crossed arms, a strange posture for a figurehead. Then the hair on my scalp and arms prickled as he slowly lifted his head.
"He's looking at us!"
Spark exclaimed.
"Oh, Lady Amber, if only you could see this! It's truly alive! The figurehead has turned and is looking at us!"
I stared at the ship, my mouth hanging open. Spark and Perseverance looked from the ship to me. I was speechless, but Lant spoke the words aloud.
"Sweet Ida! Fitz! He has your face! Right down to the break in your nose!"
Amber cleared her throat. She spoke breathlessly into our shocked silence.
"Fitz, please, I can explain everything."
Chapter 11. Passage. This is my most frightening dream. I dream it as a vine that splits into two branches. On one branch, there are four candles growing. One by one, they are kindled to flame, but their light does not illuminate. Instead, a crow says, "Here are four candles to light you to bed. Four candles lit means their child is dead. Four candles burn for the end of their ways. The wolf and the jester have wasted their days." Then, on the other branch of the vine, three candles are suddenly kindled. Their light is almost blinding, and the same crow says, "Three flames burn brighter than the sun. Their blaze engulfs an evil done. Their angry mourning purpose gives. They do not know their child still lives." Then the crow suddenly has a broken candle. She drops it, and I catch it. In a slow and frightening voice, she says, "Child, light the fire. Burn the future and the past. It's what you were born to do." I woke up, shaking all over, and I got out of bed and ran to my parents' chamber. I wanted to sleep with them, but instead my mother brought me back to my bed and lay down beside me. She sang me a song until I could fall asleep again. I was very young when I dreamed this. I had only recently learned how to climb out of my bed, but I have never forgotten the dream or the crow's rhyme. I draw the candle as I held it, broken, and the pieces held together only by the wick in the middle.
Dream Journal of B. Farseer.
The very best part of our sea voyage was how sick Dwalia was. We had a tiny room for all four of us. There were two narrow bunks in it. Dwalia took one, and for days she stayed in it. Her vomit bucket and her sweaty bedding stank. In the windowless cabin, the smells in the still air were a soup that rose around us, thicker and deeper every day. The first 2 days of our journey, I was wretchedly seasick. Then Dwalia screeched at us that our noise and motion were making her worse and ordered us out. I tottered after Vindelire and Kerf. We passed through a dark space between the deck and the cargo hold, where oil lanterns swung gently from the beams. Bunks lined the curved walls, and in the centre, hammocks hung, some full and some empty. It smelled of tar, lamp oil, sweat, and bad food. I trailed behind Kerf to a ladder and followed him up and out of a square hatch. Out in the air, with the wind blowing chill in my face, I immediately felt better. Once my stomach accepted that the world would surge and tilt around me, I felt fine. Dwalia knew I could not escape while the ship was at sea and was too ill to think beyond that. We had brought some food with us, but sometimes we would join the other travellers at the evening meal. There was a kitchen called a galley, and a room called a mess, where the long table had a little fence around the edge to corral any sliding plates or mugs. The food was neither good nor bad, and after my privation, I was glad of anything to eat on a regular basis. I spoke little, obeyed the few commands Dwalia gave, and fiercely observed every detail of the ship and my two companions. I wished them to believe that I had given up defiance to lull their vigilance. I hoped to discover a way to escape at the next port. The breeze that filled our sails bore me ever farther from my home. Moment by moment, day by day, my former life receded from me. No one could rescue me. No one knew where I was. If I was to escape this fate, I would have to do it myself. I doubted I could win my way back to the six duchies, but I could hope for a free life for myself, even if it was in a strange port half a world away from my home. Dwalia ordered Vindelire to make us uninteresting to the crew and the other passengers, and he kept a loose spell around us. No one spoke to us or watched us as we wandered the ship. Most of the passengers were Chalcedian merchants, accompanying cargo to other destinations. A few were from Bingtown or the Rain Wilds, and some were from Jamalia. The wealthy stayed in cabins. The younger ones filled the canvas hammocks. There were slaves, too, some valuable. I saw a beautiful woman who strode with the pride of a stud horse, despite her slave collar and the pale tattoo beside her nose. I wondered if she had ever been free. I watched an elderly man with a bent back sold for a stack of gold coins. He was a scholar who could speak six languages and read and write in all of them. He sat stoically as a woman drove a hard bargain for him. Then he bent to ink and paper to write out the bill of sale for himself, his nose very close to the paper. I wondered how much scribe work was left in his knobby fingers and what would become of him as he aged further. Time passes differently on a ship. Day and night, there were always sailors running from task to task. A bell ringing broke time into watches, and I could not seem to sleep through it. When it woke me at night on the splintery cabin floor, breathing the sour fog of Dwalia's sickness, I longed to escape onto the deck. But Kerf slept snoring across the narrow door. In the bunk above Dwalia's, Vindelire muttered in his sleep. If I slept, I dreamed, sometimes the dreams that boiled and seethed in me. When I woke from those, I traced an account of them onto the plank floor and tried desperately to set them out of my mind, for they were dark dreams of death and blood and smoke. Several nights into our voyage, as I lay on the floor surrounded by our sparse belongings, I heard Vindelire moan a single word.
"Brother,"
he said and sighed, sinking deeper into his dreams. I ventured to let crumble the walls I held so firmly against him during the day, and stilled my mind to sense his boundaries. It wasn't what I expected. Even in his sleep, he kept a leash on Kerf. The Chalcedian had become passive as a milk cow, an attitude much at odds with his warrior's harness and scars. He asked for the food he took, and the female passengers were safe from his stare, even the line of female slaves who were picketed on the deck once a day to take the air. Tonight, I could feel how Vindelire draped him in boredom one step short of despair. All triumphant and pleasurable memories were hidden from him. He recalled only days of dull duty. Every day would be yet another one of following his commander's orders, and his commander was Dwalia. I tried to feel Vindelire's control of me, but if he tried, it was too subtle for me to find. I had not expected to find a foggy veil draping Dwalia. Perhaps she had requested it of him. Did she wish to sleep? It was unlikely that she wished to feel so sick as to daily remain in her bed. She had betrayed how much she detested him. The day she flung insults at him, he had cowered before her disdain. Had that been the first time she had revealed her loathing of him? I explored what he suggested to her. She could trust Vindelire to manage us. He had repented his brief rebellion. He was her servant, totally loyal to her. He could control Kerf and conceal me for as long as she needed to rest. I tiptoed around the edges of that fog of suggestion. How deep did his careful defiance of her go? Would she guess it when she recovered from her seasickness? If he allowed her to recover from being seasick, I considered that thought. Was he keeping her queasy? Dwalia, ill in bed, relieved us of her slaps, pinches, and kicks. Was he starting to turn against her? If he no longer served Dwalia, if he wanted his freedom, could I feed that? Could I win him to my side, to escape, to go home? The instant that seed came into my mind, I threw up my walls as stoutly as I could. He must not suspect what I knew, let alone what I hoped. How did I win his loyalty? What did he most desire?
"Brother,"
I breathed in little more than a whisper. The rhythm of his stentorian breathing faltered, hitched, and then went on. I challenged myself. Was it possible to make my situation worse?
"Brother, I cannot sleep."
His snoring stopped. After a long silence, he said in wonder,
"You called me brother."
"As you call me," I responded. What did it mean to him? I must be careful what I invoked.
"As I dreamed I would call you, and that you would call me in return."
His head shifted on the bundled clothing that served him for a pillow. Sadly, he added,
"But the rest of this has not matched my dream, my only dream."
"Your dream?"
"Yes,"
he admitted. With bashful pride, he added,
"No one else ever dreamed it, only me."
"How could they? It was your dream."
"You are so ignorant of dreams. Many whites share the same dreams. If many whites have dreamed it, it is important to the path. If a dream comes only once, it probably won't happen, unless a brave person works hard to make it happen, to find the other dreams that show the journey to it, as Dwalia did for me."
Dwalia shifted in her bunk, a terrifying sound. So stupid of me. Of course she would be wakeful. The old snake never truly slept. She had heard our whispered words and would thwart my plan before I even formed it. And then I felt it. Deep and blessed sleep rolled over me like the softest of blankets, warm but not stifling, muscles eased, headache gentled away, free of the cabin's foul stench. I almost sank into it despite my walls. I wondered how strong it was for Dwalia, and if it drenched Kerf too. Should I tell Vindelire that I knew what he was doing? Could I threaten to betray him to Dwalia if he did not help me?
"You feel what I do, and you guard yourself from it."
"Yes," I admitted, as denying it seemed useless. I waited for him to say more, but he didn't. He had seemed so fatuous to me, but now, in his silence, I wondered if he considered his strategy. What ploy did I have to get him to speak? "Would you tell me of your dream?" He rolled onto his side. I could tell from his voice that he faced me now. He sent his whisper across the small cabin.
"Every morning, Samisal would call for paper and brush. He and I were twice brothers, our parents, sister and brother, and their parents also. So sometimes I pretended that I had dreamed, too, the same dream he had. But they always called me a liar. They knew. So Samisal had all the dreams, and I had only one. Even Odessa, my twin, born as badly made as I was, had dreams. But I had only one. Useless Vindelire."
Brother bred to sister? His parentage horrified me, but it had not been his doing. I held back my dismay to say only, "But you had one dream?"
"I did. I dreamed I found you. On a day white with snow, I called you brother, and you came with me."
"It came true, then?"
"Dreams don't come true," he corrected. "If the dream is on the true path, we journey toward it. The four know the path. They find the correct dreams and send forth servants to make the path for the world to follow. Finding the dream moment is like finding a guidepost on the road. It confirms the path is true."
"I see," I said, though I didn't. "So your dream brought us together."
"No,"
he admitted sadly.
"My dream was only a tiny dream, a little tiny part. Not very important, Dwalia says. I should not think I was important. Many people had better dreams than mine, and those who sought the dreams and put them in order, the collators, knew where we should go and what we should do to make the true path."
"Did all the dreams say I was a boy?" That question was simple curiosity on my part.
"I don't know. Most called you a son, or didn't say what you were. In my dream, you were my brother.
I heard him scratch some part of himself.
So Dwalia is right. My dream was small and not very correct.
He sounded like a disappointed child, hoping someone would disagree with him.
But you saw me, and you did call me brother. Did anyone else dream that part?
I had never known that silence could be slow, but his was. Satisfaction and vindication vied in his voice as he said,
No, no one else dreamed it.
So perhaps you were the only one who could have found me, brother. No one else could have fulfilled that dream.
Yes.
He savored the word. This silence seemed a necessary pause in the world, a time for Vindelire to possess something he had not realized belonged to him. I held it for as long as I could. Then I asked, So for the dream to be true and confirm the path, it had to be you. But why did it have to be me?
Because you are the one, the unexpected son, the one in so many dreams.
Are you sure? Alaria and Repin doubted it.
You have to be. You must be.
He sounded more desperate than certain. He had called me the unexpected son when he first found me. I pried a bit more at that. So in your dream, you were the one to find the unexpected son, and it was me.
I dreamed.
His words trailed away.
I dreamed I found you. Dwalia needed to find the unexpected son.
He sounded both frightened and angry as he said,
I wouldn't have found you if she hadn't been looking for him. She told me to look for him, and I found you, and I knew you from my dream. So you are the unexpected son.
He gave a sharp huff of annoyance that I had doubted him. He knew his logic was flawed. I could not see him in the darkness to read his face. I spoke gently to avoid angering him. But how? How do you know that when I do not know it?
I know I dreamed you. I know I found you. There is not much white in me. Some mock me and say none at all. But if I was meant to do one thing as a white, I was meant to find you. And I did.
Satisfaction warmed those words. He yawned suddenly, and his voice went soft at the edges.
When I am on the path, I can feel it. It's a nice feeling. Safe. You are not a true dreamer, so you would not know these things.
He sighed.
It makes no sense to me. In all the dreams they quoted me, the unexpected son is the balancing point. Beyond him, all is orderly, or all is chaos. At some point, you set us all on a false course. But the divergence created by the unexpected sun may be full of terrible destruction, or wondrous good. The course you create might lead toward a thousand possible futures that no one else could open.
His voice dwindled away. He sighed.
I need to sleep now, brother. I cannot rest during the day. When Kerf is asleep is my only chance.
Rest then,
brother.
I lay still, and for the rest of the night I slept little and plotted much. I stacked up my precious bits of knowledge. Vindelire had begun to deploy his powers against Dwalia. Controlling Kerf was wearying to him. He believed I was very important, and so, perhaps, did Dwalia. But did she still think that I was the unexpected son? With a few kind words, I had cheered Vindelire. Might more conversation recruit him to my side? I built a fragile hope. If Vindelire would aid me, we could flee Dwalia in the next port. Surely he could use his magic to smooth my journey home. I smiled, imagining riding up the carriageway to Withywoods. Perseverance would come to meet me. Perhaps my father, too, and Revel would open the door and come down the... But Revel was dead. The stables were burnt. Scribe Lant was dead. and maybe Purr too. I wondered again if Shun had survived and reached home. She had proven herself far tougher than I had imagined her to be. If she had, would she have told them how they took me through a stone? And if she did, would they try to follow and find me? My heart knew a lurch of hope. My father knew how to travel through the stones. Surely he would come after me. I curled into a smaller huddle on the floor. A worry tugged at me. Could he guess that we had entered the stone again? The scent of my mother's candle tucked in the front of my shirt reached me. For a moment, it was comfort. Then it was alarm, followed by certainty. I'd found the candle because my father had brought it there. Shun had reached home. She told them where they had taken me, and he had followed. Followed and somehow passed me in the stone. He had dropped this candle, dropped it, and never picked it up again? I thought of the scatter of possessions I'd found, the tattered remnants of a tent. The bear's cat! Had he been attacked there? Had he died? Were his scattered bones sunken in the deep moss under the trees? I reached for Wolffather.
If my father was dead, would you know?
I felt no response. I huddled tight behind my walls. If my father was dead, then no one was coming to rescue me. Not ever. And my dreadful dreams of what I would become would come true. Unless I saved myself.
Chapter 12. The Live Ship Paragon.
For generations, the secret of how live ships were created was known only to certain Traeder families. By the end of the war with Chaelsed, and with the emergence of the dragon Tintaglia, parts of the secret could no longer be concealed. Over the last decade, the paradox of the living ship, loyal to the family that created it by destroying the creature it would have become, has become even clearer. The creation of the live ship begins with a dragon's cocoon. When Rain Wilders first discovered immense logs of an unusual wood, they had no idea that they were dragon pods. The logs had been stored in a glass-roofed chamber in ruins that lay buried beneath the city of Treehog. The finders assumed they were especially treasured timbers of exotic wood. At the time, the Rain Wilders desperately needed a material that would resist the acid floods of the Rain Wild River. No matter how well-oiled and seasoned their hulls, traditional ships suffered gradual damage from the river water, and during times of white floods, when the river flowed particularly acidic, some boats simply dissolved, spilling cargo and passengers into the toxic water. The timber discovered in the buried Elderling cities proved to be exactly what they needed. Wizard wood, as they named it, was a fine-grained, dense timber and proved to be ideal for shipbuilding and resistant to the river's acid. Ships built from this substance were the only ones that could endure repeated journeys on the acid water of the Rain Wild River. These highly desirable vessels became an essential link in the trade in Elderling artifacts, which could be ferried out of the ancient ruined cities in the Rain Wild settlements. There they could be marketed at exorbitant prices to the world at large. It was several generations before the first figurehead on a live ship woke. Builders and owners were astonished. The Golden Dawn was the first figurehead to take on life. Conversation with the figurehead soon revealed that the ship had absorbed the memories of those who had lived aboard him, especially those of his captains, and an attachment to the family who owned him. The ship's knowledge extended to navigation, to the handling of weather and awareness of necessary maintenance. The value of such a ship became inestimable. Those who cut the timbers into lumber must have had early knowledge that these logs were not wood. In the heart of each log, they must have discovered a partially formed dragon. Even if they could not discern what it was, they undoubtedly knew it had contained a living creature at some time. That was the deepest secret of all, one the families kept concealed from all but Bloodkin. It is believed that prior to the emergence of the dragon Tintaglia from a wizard wood log, the live ships themselves were not cognizant of their relationship to dragons.
Of the Bingtown live ships, Trader Caldra Redwined. I stood on Tarman's deck and stared up at Paragon's figurehead. My face.
and an axe sheathed in the harness across his chest. Lant and Perseverance were transfixed.
Spark whispered,
"He's looking at us."
He was indeed. The figurehead of the docked vessel looked as affronted as I felt. Harrigan resembled me in almost every way.
"You can't possibly explain this."
"I can,"
Amber assured me.
"But not now, later, in private, I promise."
I made no answer. As the distance between the ships closed, Tarman's crew was busy with their poles, slowing and adroitly guiding him closer to the riverbank. Treehog was a busy trade center, and there was little open dock space. Ships followed the custom of mooring to one of the docked vessels and crossing a neighboring deck to reach the shore. I assumed we would do likewise. There was an open space near Paragon, but I judged it too tight a fit for Tarman. As we grew closer to Paragon, he returned my gaze, scowling.
"Why does he have blue eyes?" I wondered aloud.
My own were dark. Amber had a strangely sentimental smile on her face. She held her clasped hands to her breast like a grandmother looking on a beloved child, and spoke fondly.
"Paragon chose them. Many of the Ludlucks, including Kennet, had blue eyes. The Ludlucks were originally his family. I carved his face, Fitz. Or rather, I recarved it. He had been blinded, his eyes chopped away with a hatchet. He'd been branded with the mark of his tormentor. Oh, it's a long and terrible story. When I carved his face, I carved him with his eyes closed, as he wished. For some time he refused to open them. When he did, they were blue."
"Why my face?"
I demanded. We were nearing the dock.
"Later," she quietly requested.
Her word was almost lost in the shouted orders as Tarman neared Paragon. Tarman's crew had sprung into action. My four companions and I stood on top of the deckhouse, out of the way, and watched. Our tillerman worked the oar to hold us against the current as the others used poles to keep Tarman from meeting the dock too firmly. On two of the moored vessels, worried deckhands stood ready to stave us off. But Tarman nudged into place as precisely as a sword returning to a sheath. Skelly leapt from Tarman's deck to the dock, and in the next moment caught a flung line. She took a quick wrap around a cleat, then dashed down the dock to catch the next mooring line. Our squat river barge was a sharp contrast with the tall sailing ship. Tarman's shallow draft enabled him to travel up the river, where deep-keeled ships like Paragon could not go. Paragon was meant for deep water and tall waves. He dwarfed us. The figurehead that stared down at us was several times life-sized. His gaze shifted suddenly from me to the woman beside me, and his judgmental frown blossomed into a smile of incredulity.
"Amber, is that you? Where have you been for the last 20-odd years?"
He reached huge hands toward her, and if we had been any closer, I think he would have plucked her off Tarman's deck. She lifted her outstretched arms as if to offer an embrace.
"Far and away, my friend, far and away. It is so good to hear your voice again."
"But not to see me. Your eyes are blind. Who has done this to you?"
Concern vied with anger.
"Blind as you once were, it's a long tale, old friend, one I promise to tell you."
"That you will. Who is this with you?"
Was there an edge of accusation in his voice?
"Friends of mine from Buck Duchy, of the Six Duchies. But let me save that telling for when I am on board. Shouting across a dock is no way to converse."
"I agree."
This shouted comment came from a small, dark-haired woman leaning over Paragon's railing. Her teeth were white in a wind-weathered face.
"Come aboard and welcome. Leftrin and Elise will send your things over, and then I hope they'll join us for a glass or two. Amber, well met. I could scarcely believe the news the bird brought. Come aboard."
She shifted her gaze to me, and her grin widened.
I look forward to meeting the man who shares a face with our ship.
With that, she ducked back out of sight. At her words, Paragon's smile dimmed, and he crossed his arms on his chest. He turned his head and watched Amber from the corner of his eyes. She gave me a half a smile.
That was Althea Vestrid, aunt to Queen Multa. She's either the captain or the mate on Paragon, depending on who you ask.
She turned her face toward me.
You will like her and Brashantrell.
Docking and disembarking was a precise and slow process. Captain Leftrin had to be completely satisfied with the docking before he would allow a gangplank to be lowered. He ordered that our possessions be transferred to Paragon. Then he and Elise escorted my small party down the gangplank, across the dock, and then up a rope ladder flung down to us from Paragon's railing. Leftrin led the way, and Lant and then Perseverance followed easily enough. Spark's skirts gave her a bit of trouble as she ascended. I stood holding the ladder taut and waiting for Amber to ascend.
No need,
the figurehead announced. He twisted lithely from his waist, leaned down low, and offered Amber his outstretched hands.
The figurehead is reaching for you. Be cautious,
I warned her in a low voice. She did not lower her voice.
I have no need of caution among old friends. Guide me, Fitz.
I did so reluctantly and held my breath as the figurehead closed his hands around her ribs as if she were a child. I stood staring as Paragon lifted her in his huge hands. They were the color of a man's hands, swarthy with many days outside, but I could still see the grain of the wizard wood he'd been carved from. Of all the elderling magic, the living figurehead most astonished me, but also created the most unease in me. A dragon, I could understand. It was a creature of flesh and blood, with the same needs and appetites as any animal. But a ship of living wood, something that moved and spoke and apparently thought, but had no need of food or drink, no drive to mate, no hope of progeny? How could one predict the actions or the desires of such a being? From my position as the last person standing on the docks, beside Paragon's ladder, I could hear Amber's voice, but she pitched her words to the figurehead, and I could not make them out. He held her like a doll and looked intently into her face. Having been blinded himself, would he feel sympathy for her? Could a ship carved out of a dragon cocoon feel sympathy? Not for the first time, I confronted how little of his life the fool had shared with me. Here he was known as Amber, a clever, tough woman who had lent her fortune to rebuild Bingtown and help former slaves build new lives in the Rain Wilds. For this portion of our journey, that was who she must be. Amber, a woman who was still a stranger to me.
Fitz?
Lant leaned over Paragon's railing.
Are you coming?
Yes. I climbed up the rope ladder, never as easy a task as it seemed, and stepped onto Paragon's deck. He felt different from Tarman, much closer to human. With wit and skill, I sensed him as a living creature. For now, his attention was focused on Amber. I had a few moments to look around. It had been a long time since I'd been on a ship of this size. I thought back to my journey to the Out Islands and Thick's protracted seasickness. There was an experience I hoped never to repeat. Paragon was smaller than that ship, sleeker and, I suspected, more seaworthy. Paragon was very well kept. The decks were clear, the lines neatly stowed, and even while the ship was tied to the dock, the crew was well occupied. "Where are Spark and Perseverance?" I asked Lant.
"Exploring, with the permission of Captain Brashen. You and I are invited to join the captain and Lady Althea in their stateroom for refreshments and conversation."
I leaned toward the bow where Paragon still held Amber. I was reluctant to leave her literally in the ship's grasp, and equally reluctant to offend the folk offering us free passage to Bingtown. There was a lengthy journey ahead of us, down the Rainwild River and then along the uncertain and boggy coast of the cursed shores until we reached Trader Bay. I wished to be on good terms with all. I doubted the fool would have any caution around the figurehead. Obviously Amber had long ago made her decision to trust him.
Fitz? Lant nudged me. I'm coming. I glanced back at Amber. I could see her face, but not his. The wind off the river was rustling her skirts and stirring the bits of hair that showed around her scarf. She was smiling at something he'd said. Her arms rested easily on top of his hands, as if they were the arms of a comfortable chair. I decided to trust her instincts and followed Lant. The door into the captain's stateroom was open to the spring day, and I heard lively voices. Spark laughed at something. We entered to see Leftrin gripping the back of Purr's collar and holding him almost off the floor.
"He's a rascal and a lackwit, so see you work him hard," he announced.
Just as my muscles tightened, Leftrin laughed and gave the grinning boy a half-shove, half-toss toward a well-muscled man of middle years. The man caught my boy by the shoulder and grinned in return, showing very white teeth in a neatly trimmed beard. He slapped Purr on the back.
"Running the rigging is what we call it, and yes, you can learn it. But only if Clef, Althea, or I authorize it. We'll tell you when we want you up there and exactly what we want you to do."
The man glanced up at Leftrin.
"Does he know any of his knots?"
"A few," I interjected into the conversation. I found I was smiling at Captain Trell.
"Or more than a few,"
Leftrin objected.
"Belin had him working on them in the evenings, when you were closeted with your lady. We've given him a good start on being a deckhand. But Trell is right, lad. If you venture into the rigging, go the first times with someone who knows what she's about. And listen. Listen exactly, and do exactly, and only what you are told. Do you hear me?"
"I do, sir." Purr was grinning from one captain to the other. If he'd been a puppy, he'd have been wriggling all over. I felt proud and a bit jealous. Trell advanced toward me, hand out, and we exchanged a trader's handshake. His dark eyes met mine, a frank and open gaze.
"I've never had a prince on board, but Leftrin tells me you're an easy one to deal with. We do our best, but Paragon is a ship, and we live as that dictates."
"I assure you, I'm not a grand noble. I spent a fair amount of time pulling an oar on the Rurisk during the Red Ship Wars. My gear was under my bench, and half the time that was my bed as well."
"Ah, you'll do well then. I'd like to introduce Althea Vestrit. I've tried to make her a Trell, but she persists in being a Vestrit, stubbornness being the hallmark of her family's women. But if you've met Malta, you'll know that already."
Althea was seated at a table laden with a fat steaming pot, cups, and little cakes on a platter. The pot was elderling made. It had a gleaming metallic finish and was embellished with snakes. No, they were sea serpents, for tiny fish were also there. The little cakes were studded with seeds and bits of bright pink fruit. Althea half stood and leaned over the table to extend her handshake to me.
"Don't mind him, though my niece did get more than her fair share of Vestrit's character, as we call it."
The calluses on her hand rasped against mine. Her smile made lines at the corners of her eyes. Her dark hair was threaded with grey and was bound back from her face and braided into a tight queue down her back. Her grip was the equal of any man's, and I felt she took my measure as much as I did hers. She sat down again and said,
"Well, it's a strange pleasure to see the man who wears my ship's face, though doubtless you think of it the other way. Please, come to our table, have a cup of coffee, and tell me how it felt to see the figurehead, Amber, carved to match the man who held her heart."
The silence that follows a very awkward statement has a peculiar noise of its own. I could hear Lant holding his breath and literally feel the wide-eyed stares from Spark and Perseverance. I found a hasty lie.
"Coffee would be welcome. It may be spring, but the wind off the river cuts right down to my bones."
She grinned.
"You never knew she'd carved your face for the ship, did you?"
Was honesty becoming a dangerous habit? What would Shade have thought? I allowed myself an embarrassed laugh and conceded, "Until a very short time ago, I did not."
"Oh, sweet sir,"
Althea muttered, and Brashen brayed out the suppressed laugh that he could hold back no longer. I heard a soft exclamation behind me and turned to find that Elise had joined us.
"Oh, the things our women do to us,"
Brashen exclaimed, and came to clap me on the shoulder.
Sit down, and Althea will pour. There's brandy, too, and that might take the chill away a bit better. Elise? Lord Lant, will you join us? And, well, if I invite your serving folk to join us, am I breaching manners? You'll have to bluntly advise me on these things.
Travelling rough soon breaks down the walls of protocol. Perseverance and Spark, would you care to join us for coffee? Perseverance made a face before he could control his features.
No, sir. Thank you very much all the same. Oh, I'd like to go and look around the ship, if I may.
You may,
Althea and Brashen said in unison, and then Brashen thought to look toward me and add,
That is, if your master approves.
Of course, Per. If someone tells you to get out of the way, jump lively.
I will.
He was halfway to the cabin door when Spark spoke.
I want,
she began, and then halted. Her cheeks turned red. Every adult was looking at her. Elise smiled.
Just say it, dear.
She opened her mouth and then said in a subdued voice,
I should see to unpacking Lady Amber's things.
Or,
Elise suggested,
you could go and look about the deck with Per, and no harm done for being interested in the ship. From the Rainwilds to Bingtown, women have stood on an equal footing with men for quite some time, even if some forget it from time to time.
She smiled at me.
When you were otherwise occupied, Spark had many questions for Belin and me about Tarman. She learns quickly, and I assure you there's no harm in a girl knowing more than ribbons and sewing.
I defended the Six Duchies. I assure you, in the Six Duchies, we do not confine our women at all. They are minstrels and guards, scribes and huntswomen, or whatever other occupation appeals to them. Spark found her tongue.
I wasn't asking permission, that is, I was, but I also wanted to ask if it would offend if I donned trousers for my time on the ship. For I, too, would like to climb the rigging, and skirts make it a task even to climb the ship's ladder.
A peculiar look passed over Perseverance's face. He stood, his hand on the door, and looked at Spark as if she had turned into a cat. Althea stood up and dusted her hands on the legs of her well-worn trousers.
I think we could find you some boys' clothing on board the ship.
Spark grinned, and suddenly I saw Ash's countenance.
I've some from home, if no one minds me wearing them.
It won't be noticed at all. I truly don't know how Elise Masters, being ever the lady in lovely skirts.
Althea smiled at her friend before nodding to Spark.
Run off and find your other clothes. All your gear should be on board in your cabins. We're a larger vessel than Tarman, but we're built for cargo, not passengers. I've put Prince Fitzchivalry and Lady Amber in the same room she once shared with Jack and me. Lord Lant, Clef has offered to share his cabin with you. He's given you the bunk, and we'll hang a hammock for him. Per, we put below decks with the crew.
She gave me an apologetic look.
For now, we put your serving girl in with you and Amber, but...
Actually, I don't mind a hammock below decks alongside Perseverance. It's better than sleeping on an open deck.
Oh, we can do better than that. No need to separate you from your lady.
This from Brashen. We were back to an awkward silence as I sought words. It was broken by a loud shout that vibrated the planks of the deck.
Althea! Paragon,
she explained unnecessarily.
I'd best see what he needs. Don't wait for me, but help yourself to coffee and cakes. Brashen, would you show them where their cabins are?
Of course.
We must take our leave, I fear.
This from Elise with her hand on Leftrin's arm.
There's cargo to load. It must be tallied as it comes aboard and stored to Leftrin's liking. This cargo cannot brook delay. Young fruit trees in tubs of earth from Bingtown, and ducklings and goslings. I suspect we'll be sorry to have those aboard, but they cannot be worse than the sheep were. Farewell. We enjoyed your company.
Hasty good wishes were exchanged, and they took their leave. After Althea had left, Trell said quietly,
Our ship is out of temper lately. My son is serving aboard a different live ship right now. Vivacia, the Vestrit family ship. Paragon misses him keenly. Sometimes he can be like a spoiled child. If he says anything peculiar to you, let me know.
He looked troubled, and I strove to keep the alarm from my face as I wondered what sort of tantrum a living ship might throw. He avoided meeting my eyes as he added,
Let me show you around a bit. The pot will keep the coffee hot.
As we left the cabin, Lant raised his brows at me, and I gave a shrug. Brashen handed Purr off to the deckhand named Clef. He had an old slave tattoo beside his nose and a long tarred braid down his back.
"Got your gear below," he said to Purr, with an echo of a foreign accent faded beyond recognition.
They went off together, and I smiled to see Purr unconsciously mimic the sailor's walk. Lant followed them. Brashen led Spark and me to a cabin that was largely occupied by Amber's and Spark's baggage. My own pack seemed small in comparison with their bulging bags. I wondered if they had acquired more garments in Kelsingra, and how we would manage when it came time to carry our possessions on our backs. My smaller pack that held Bee's books and Molly's candles had safely crossed to Paragon. The elderling firebrick resided there as well. I hefted it, and knew that below Shade's carefully packed firepots, my shirt still bundled the heavy glass containers of skill. Amber had taken charge of the lovely bracelet. Spark immediately burrowed into her bag like a hound in search of a remembered bone. We left her there. As we walked toward the bow, Trell introduced me to crew members. They gave a nod or smile, but never paused in their tasks. Kittle, Cord, Twan, Half, Ant, Jock, Cyprus. I stacked the names in my memory and tried to attach them to faces. Ant was halfway up the mast, and my heart jumped when she waved at me with both hands. Trell was not amused.
"One hand for yourself and one for the ship," he roared. "You don't take unnecessary risks on my deck. I'll put you right back in the tree you came from."
"Sir,"
she responded, and went scampering up the mast like a squirrel avoiding a barking dog. Trell rolled his eyes.
"If she lives to grow up, she'll be a great deckhand, but she doesn't have a scrap of fear, and that may get her killed."
He gestured at Treehog.
"When a child grows up there, the mast of a ship seems short."
I followed his waving hand. The towering trees that held Treehog dwarfed the naked masts of the Paragon. The swooping branches of the dense forest were as busy with foot traffic as the streets and byways of any city. Everywhere throughout the trees were signs of human habitation. Signboards advertised a tavern, while another in the shape of a basket advertised all manner of wickerwork. I saw some people veiled, as I had always heard the Rainwilders went, and others with exposed faces and bared arms that revealed scales and growths. A wicker lift was hoisted into the upper branches, while pedestrians travelled up and down a stairway that spiralled around the trunk. I had stopped to gawk and realized that Brashen was waiting for me.
"Did you grow up here?" I asked Brashen. "Here? Oh, no. I'm Bingtown born and bred from an illustrious trade of family, but I'm the black sheep and not the heir, so here I am, captaining a live ship instead of minding the family fortune."
He was clearly well satisfied with his lot.
"Not too different from my tale," I told him.
"Amber may call me a prince, but my name tells the truth. Fitz means I was born on the wrong side of the blankets, so I'm a farseer, but a bastard one."
"That's so. Well, that explains why you might end up on the end of an oar on a war galley."
I grinned. "Yes, bastards are a bit more expendable than princes." And that simply, we were at ease with each other. We strolled toward the bow. I could hear voices, Amber's and Althea's, and the ship's, but the wind off the river and the noise of the tree city meant I could not make out their words.
"Vengeance, then?"
Althea asked as we drew closer.
"More than vengeance," Amber replied. "We go to break a cage of cruelty, to destroy a court that has grown only greedier and more corrupt with every passing year."
She lowered her voice and spoke the words I had so often heard from her.
"We go to be the rock in the cart track that bounces the wagon onto a new path."
They could not have presented a stranger scene. Althea leaned on the ship's railing. The ship's face was turned toward the river with my more youthful profile. Amber sat in the figurehead's finger-laced hands. Her hands rested lightly on his thumbs, and she swung her daintily booted feet, ankles crossed, over the empty fall to the cold, acid rush of the river.
Her scarf allowed a feathering of short hair to frame her face. Powder and paint had smoothed her scarring and the scaling that the dragon's blood had triggered. In Amber's guise, the fool became a very fetching woman. Althea's voice was subdued.
"I've never heard you speak with such passion, not even when we were facing our deaths together."
Amber's face contorted with hatred.
"They took our child and destroyed her."
It hurt to hear Amber claim be that way, and I knew what Althea and Brashen must assume. The fool might believe it was so, but to hear him speak of her that way to strangers wounded something in me.
"Molly," I thought fiercely. She had been Bee's mother, and no other. I did not wish these people to think I had fathered Bee upon Amber. No, Molly had been the one to endure that pregnancy, in some ways, so alone, and Molly had been the one to cherish and protect a child that others would have let dwindle away. It wasn't right for Amber to erase her. The hurt seared me, and I realized it had another source.
"My boy is gone too,"
Paragon burst out, and I felt the surge of emotion that washed through the ship. His sense of outrage and loss were fueling the fire of hurt within me. Trell spoke calmingly.
"Boyo is fine, Paragon. Vivaseer would never let harm befall him. He is only gone from you for a time. He will return, you know that."
"Will he?"
Paragon demanded harshly.
"He has been gone 2 years. Will he ever come back? Or will Vivaseer claim him? He was born here, on my decks. He is mine. Or am I the only live ship without a family? The only live ship with no heir to my captaincy? For even as Althea's brother demands my boy for his deck, he keeps from me what should be mine. Kennet's son."
"Queen Etta keeps Paragon Kennetsome from you, not Wintrow."
Althea's voice was taut. I could hear it was not the first time she had uttered those words to the ship. I saw Brashen square his shoulders and step forward, prepared to take up the peacemaker's role.
"Paragon," Amber said softly. "My friend, I feel your anguish. It is almost too much to be borne. Please."
And then breathlessly,
"You are holding me too tightly. Please, please set me safely on your decks."
I stared helplessly. I had two small concealed knives, useless weapons against such a huge opponent. If I attacked him, would he drop Amber into the river? I looked to Brashen, but his face had gone pale. Althea leaned further over the railing. She spoke in a low, rational voice.
"Crushing your friend will not win you Kennet's son. Calm yourself, ship."
What need of breath did a wooden ship have, even one carved from a dragon's cocoon? Yet Paragon's chest rose and fell as if he were a boy in the grip of strong emotion. His eyes were squeezed shut, and the big hands that clutched Amber trembled. Amber's milky eyes were fixed, not on me, but on a nameless distance. Her face was flushed with breathlessness. Paragon drew his hands closer to his chest. He bent his head over her, and I feared he would bite her head off. But instead, he twisted his shoulders and released her onto the deck so abruptly that she staggered and fell. Althea dropped to one knee beside her, seized her shoulders, and dragged her backward.
"You needn't put her out of my reach," Paragon complained hoarsely. "I would not hurt her."
"I know you wouldn't,"
Amber gasped. Althea was small, but she hoisted Amber's arm across her shoulders and stood up with her.
"I'm taking Amber to our stateroom," she announced calmly.
Before I could step in, Brashen seized Amber's other arm and helped her to walk aft. I began to follow, but the ship suddenly spoke.
"You, with my face, don't go."
I halted. Brashen stopped and looked back at me, his eyes wide. A small shake of his head was full of warning. Lance's gaze went from me to Amber.
I tipped my head toward her, letting him know he should follow her, and he quickly took Brashen's place. The captain folded his arms and stood, watching the figurehead.
Buckman, I want to talk to you. Come here.
The ship wasn't looking at me. He was staring off across the wide, rain-wild river. The distant shore was a haze of green on the horizon. I'm here, I said, striving to keep any challenge out of my voice. The ship gave no sign he had heard me. I stood and waited. I heard the river and the ship's motion against the dock. The distant calls and shouts of the riverside city were like birdsong in the distance.
Buckman?
I stepped closer and raised my voice. I'm here, ship.
No!
Brashen's warning was too late. With a twist of his body that set the ship rocking against the dock, the figurehead turned, reached, and grabbed me. I leapt back, but he caught my left shoulder and arm. I seized one of his fingers in my right hand and tried to lift and twist it. Useless, he dragged me off my feet and pinned me against the railing.
Let him go, Paragon!
Brashen bellowed. The lurch of the ship had alerted the crew. Clef came running, then jolted to a halt, staring at me, with a white-faced purr at his elbow. Two others, Cord and Half, hurried toward us, then stopped. Althea halted, her arm still around Amber. I could not hear what she said, but Amber swiveled back to gaze blindly back at us. Paragon spoke calmly, and his words vibrated through me.
This does not concern any of you. Busy yourself with your duties.
Paragon?
Althea pleaded. Paragon tightened his grip, lifting me up onto my toes. His thumb and fingers pinched the left side of my chest. I didn't struggle. When you cannot win, avoid angering the opponent. Give him no reason to employ more force.
We're fine,
I gasped. I held onto his fingers, trying to ease the pressure.
About your duties,
Paragon suggested pleasantly, and I nodded in vehement agreement. Althea began moving Amber away. She went reluctantly, looking back at me, but I could not read her expression. Clef gripped Per's shoulder and dragged him along. Lant came to help him. Brashen, his mouth flat in a bitter line, retreated from us. Paragon eased me onto my feet, but kept me wedged against the railing.
Now, he said in a very soft voice. We will talk, you and I, to be sure that things are clear between us. Are you listening, Buckman? For that is your role in this conversation. You listen.
I wheezed a response.
I'm listening. Excellent. Amber seems to be fond of you. Perhaps she has been fond of you. For years.
He paused.
I nodded. Friends since childhood.
The pressure eased.
Friends?
Since I was a boy. He made a deep sound that I felt all through my body. Then he said,
Understand this. We share a face, though mine is more youthful and handsomer. I asked her to carve me a face she could love. She gave me yours. But it was could love, not did love. Remember that. She loves me far more than you. She always will.
On the last three words, his grip on me tightened. I nodded breathlessly. Overhead, I heard a worried caw. I could not look up, but I knew that Motley was circling. I prayed she would not try to attack the ship.
Please don't.
I flung the thought at her. Paragon snapped his fingers open. I clutched the railing so I did not fall. For an instant, I thought he had responded to my wit. Then he gave me a threatening smile.
So, we understand each other?
Yes. I fought the impulse to flee.
I did not want to turn my back to him, even if he had turned his to me. He put his gaze on the water, crossed his arms on his chest, and rolled his shoulders. Substantial musculature there. I was not sure I'd ever truly looked like that. He held his silence. A step at a time, I retreated, keeping my eyes fixed on him until someone seized my collar and dragged me backward. I kicked my heels against the deck to speed the process, and we both went down in a heap. Brashen huffed out his air as we hit the deck with me on top.
"You're welcome,"
he wheezed as I rolled off him and staggered upright. "Thank you," I responded.
"Are you all right?"
Amber was immediately beside me as Althea offered Brashen a hand up. Purr darted to my side and seized my hand. "I'm bruised, but not badly injured, other than my pride." I turned to Althea and Brashen. "You warned me. I didn't imagine he could move that quickly, or be that..." I flailed for a word.
"Deceptive," Brashen supplied for me. He sighed. "He's been difficult lately."
"More difficult than usual,"
Althea amended. She took Amber's hand and hauled her to her feet.
"It's a strange welcome back for you, Amber, but I'm sure you recall Paragon's nature. He'll be steady and stable for a month or a year, then something will set him off."
"Jealousy," I said very quietly. "Amber, he does not wish to share you."
"I will do my best to calm him, but it is not just that. Paragon's hull and figurehead were created out of two logs of wizard wood. He has the nature and partial memories of two dragons. His decks were the scene of much violence and cruelty. He was captured by the notorious pirate Igrot and used as his personal vessel, and Kennet Ludlock, the son of his family, was tormented on board him. Tormented and twisted."
She added in a whisper,
"Cruelty begets cruelty."
"Deliberate cruelty is never forgivable,"
Althea said brusquely. Amber nodded curtly.
"I understand that now, perhaps better than I once did."
We moved away from the foredeck. Brashen tossed his chin at the crewman who was staring at us, and they suddenly stirred to life. I gently pried my arm from Purr's grip. "I'm fine," I told him. "Get to learning the ship. I'll call you if I need you." He looked doubtful, but Clef gave a sharp whistle, and the boy perked like a summoned dog. "Go on," I told him, knowing it was what he longed to do and what was best for him, and he went. With a sudden rattle of black feathers, Motley swooped in to land on Purr's shoulder. Clef startled, and Purr laughed. The tension broke like a bubble popping. I left him explaining the bird to Clef and Ant. We hadn't gone more than a dozen steps when Ash abruptly appeared.
"Is all well?"
he demanded anxiously in a voice so boyish I knew he had changed his self along with his clothing. I felt a pang that we had stolen this superlative young spy just when Shade might need him most, but I also knew that her dual identity could not be used aboard the ship. "It is Spark," I told her. She gave me an odd look. "You can relax," I added. I pointed toward Clef and suggested, "Go explore the ship with Purr." She gave me a girl's relieved smile and trotted off with an eagerness that told me I'd given her exactly the right prompt. Althea ambushed me at the stateroom door with sparks of anger in her eyes.
"You can't be careless on this ship. We warned you."
"You did," I agreed. "He tricked me into coming within range. It was my own fault." My agreement set her back. Amber groped out and I offered her my arm. She gripped it tightly.
"Ah, Fitz. As you do not know Paragon's history, you cannot be as terrified as I was." "We need to get underway. People are staring. The sooner we are away from Treehog, the less they have to gossip about,"
Brashen suggested tersely. I looked toward the city. Yes, people were pointing, others just gaping. I wondered how many had witnessed what had happened, and how Paragon's jealousy would be interpreted by those who had not heard his words.
"Walk me to my room, please. I'm still recalling the ship,"
Amber lied, giving me a graceful way to depart. They didn't even ask what he'd said to me, I observed quietly.
Some of it we overheard. I had no idea he would feel so possessive of me.
Must you be so pleased about it? I demanded. She laughed.
I'd feared that he had forgotten me.
After you recarved his face and gave him back his sight?
Paragon is changeable. One moment he's an adoring child, the next a vindictive, angry adolescent. Sometimes he is manly and brave and chivalrous, but I never lean too strongly on any of his moods, for I know how quickly they can shift.
Have you really forgotten your way around the ship? A rueful smile twisted her mouth.
Fitz, you have such amazing faith in me. I haven't been on this ship in decades. I can recall the layout, but will I know how many steps from fore to aft, how many steps in a ladder, when to duck for a doorway? No, yet I must walk as if I am confident of the way. I know that when I grope or cling to a wall, I become less of a person and more of an obstacle. So I pretend I can see more than I do.
I'm sorry. And I was, and disheartened. I thought again of the long and weary way he had come, alone and horrendously wounded, blind in the snow.
Is this the door?
She asked. I think so. I was more rattled than I wanted to admit. I'd been stupid. I kept trying to think of what I should have done when Paragon seized me.
I thought you were leading me.
I was letting you hold my arm while we walked. I tapped on the door, and when no one answered, I opened it. I see your things, everywhere. There are three bunks and a fold-down table. Spark's pack is open, and she has obviously rummaged through it. Amber entered and allowed herself to grope and touch. I shut the door behind us. She moved carefully in the small room, measuring distances in careful steps and the reach of her arms.
I recall it, she said, as she perched on the lower bunk. I once shared this room with Althea and Jack. Three people crowded into this space. It was tense at times.
I pushed my pack completely under the lowest bunk and set my bag of clothing by the door. Crowding does that to you. I sat down beside her. The motion of the ship had changed, and I did not find it pleasant. We'd cast off from the dock, and the current of the river was taking charge. I looked out the small porthole. We were picking up speed and moving away from shore into a deeper channel and swifter current. I'd never liked the sensation of being disconnected from the ground. The pace of a horse had a rhythm. A ship might lurch in any direction at any moment. I tried to settle my stomach into accepting the unpredictable.
What's wrong?
She asked softly. I'm not seasick, but I don't enjoy the motion. I'd just become accustomed to Tarman's waddle, but Paragon...
No, what's really worrying you?
He spoke as the fool. I didn't look at him. Was there anyone else I could admit this to? Probably not. I'm not what I used to be. I make more mistakes, and they're more serious. I think I'm alert and ready and fit for anything, and then I'm not. Things and people take me by surprise. Brashen seizes me from behind, and I'm so focused on Paragon, not even my wit let me know he was there. Despite being warned, the ship lured me into coming within his arm's reach with almost no effort. He could have killed me in an instant.
Fitz, how old are you?
Exactly. I'm not sure. You know that.
Take a guess,
he chided me. I blew out my distaste for the subject. 62? Perhaps 63? 64, maybe. But I don't look it, and most days I don't feel it.
But you are it. It's going to take its toll. You had a good life, for a time, an easy life with Molly. Calm and prosperity dull a man's edge, just as endless battle and hardship dulls the gentler parts of the soul.
It was good, fool. I wanted it to be forever. I wanted to grow old and to die with her sitting by my bed.
But you didn't get that.
No. I got this. Chasing across half the world to kill people I don't know. People who didn't know me, but still came to destroy what little peace and joy I had left. As I put words to that, I felt a fury that would have let me snap a man's neck. Dwalia. I could have broken her in half with my bare hands at that moment. Then it passed, and I felt foolish and empty, and worst of all, incompetent. I spoke a guilty fear. They lured me away from Withywoods, didn't they, so they could raid it while I was away?
I fear they did.
How could they plan that? He had explained it before, but I wanted to hear it again.
They have access to thousands of prescient dreams from scores of young whites. They could find the right circumstances to nudge you in the direction they desired.
And you?
Probably I was part of it. Did I escape, or was I released? Were the chance strangers who helped me along the way truly kind, or were they conspirators with the servants? I don't know, Fitz, but I don't think you can blame yourself.
I make too many mistakes. I had my sword at Elik's throat, and my strength gave out. When I should have followed B into the skill pillar, my magic was gone. So many mistakes, fool. How roughly I healed those children. I looked at his empty eyes. And just now with Paragon. Stupid, stupid, stupid. I reached to seize his gloved hand. Fool, I am not competent to do what you want done. I'm going to fail you, drag you down into torture and death with me. Will Lantern purr and Spark fall with us? Will we listen to purr scream? Watch Spark abused and torn? I can't stand it. I can't stand to think of it. Do you wonder that I want to send them home, that I am terrified of bringing anyone with me into this? I fear failing all of you, as I have feared nothing else in my life. I'll fall for some tricks of theirs. How can I battle people who even now may know what I'm likely to do next? They might know that we are on our way to kill them.
Oh, I consider that likely,
the fool observed heartlessly, then added quietly,
you're hurting me.
I released my clutch, and he massaged his hand. His words had quenched my last spark of courage. In our silence, the moving ship spoke around us. I heard the water and the creaking of Paragon's wizard wood timbers, felt the press of his sentience, and tightened my walls. This is insane. I can't do this. We'll both die, possibly messily.
Probably so. But what else would we do with the rest of our lives?
I thought about that like a wolf chewing on a bare bone, or chewing on his leg in a trap.
Night eyes, he said.
He's gone, I said dully. If I still had him, I wouldn't feel so diminished. His senses were so sharp, and he shared all with me. But he's gone completely now. I used to feel him inside me sometimes. I could almost hear him, usually mocking me. But I don't even have that anymore. He's just gone.
That's not what I meant, though I'm sad to hear it. No, I was recalling Night Eyes at the end of his life. You wanted to heal him, and he refused. How you tried to leave him safe while we went after the piebalds, and he came after you.
I smiled, remembering my wolf's determination to live until he died. What are you saying? He spoke solemnly.
This is our last hunt, old wolf. And as we always have, we go to it together.
Chapter 13. Full Sails. I am so bothered when the dreams make no sense, but still swell with importance. It is hard to write down a story that has no sequence or sense, let alone make a picture of what my dream showed me. But here it is. A flaming man offers a drink to my father. He drinks it. He shakes himself like a wet dog
and pieces of wood fly in all directions. He turns into two dragons that fly away. I am almost certain that this dream will come to pass, a dream that makes no sense.
Dream Journal of B. Farcia.
It was a chill and rainy day. I wore my old jerkin over the cheap, loose shirt and trousers Dwalia had grudgingly purchased for me in Chaleshead. The layers were uncomfortable, but I had no coat. Kerf, Vindelire, and I had fled the stench in the tiny cabin. We huddled in the skimpy shelter of the deckhouse eaves and watched the heaving grey seas amid the endless, pattering rain. Few merchants wished to take the air that day. The two who trudged past us in deep conversation made my heart leap with hope.
6 days to Wharton. I'll part with my Sands Edge brandy there for a tidy profit. I want to look at their currant liqueur. It has a tartness that wakes the tongue and is as good a tonic for a man as it is a pleasure to the ladies.
He was a small man, lithe as a rat, and dressed all in ratty grey. The tall woman beside him laughed and shook her head. The bangles in her ears brushed her shoulders. A nest of yellow braids crowned her head, hatless in the rain.
I've no stock to sell there, but I hope to acquire an item or two. It's not called Walton for nothing. Their weavers make magnificent rugs. If I take one as a gift to my buyer in the Spice Isles, he may spend his client's money a bit more freely. I'll be glad to get off this ship for a bit. We've a layover there before a 7-day run to Cart's Cove, if this wind holds.
The wind is good, but this rain I'd wish gone.
Storm is good by me.
The woman looked up, letting the rain fall on her face. The man stared at her bared throat.
Nice chance of pirates or the tariff fleet spotting us, but I'm looking forward to a couple of days on dry land.
2 days in port, 2 days in which to find a way off the ship and out of Dwalia's custody. 6 days to win Vindelire over to my cause. If he fled with me and kept us both hidden, what chance would Dwalia have of finding us? I knew that luring him from his path would be like luring a wild bird from a berry bush. The wrong words might frighten him off completely. I would have to be very careful. I put myself on a strict schedule. For 3 days I would court his friendship. Only on the fourth would I begin to persuade him to help me. Kerf hunched beside me, his shoulders bowed against the rain, his face nearly blank with Vindelire's overlay of servitude. I felt sorry for him. He looked like a once proud stallion hitched to a dung cart. At night, when he stripped for sleep, I noticed the slackening of the muscles in his arms and chest. Under Vindelire's sway, he moved less and less like a warrior and more like a servant. Much more of this, and he would lose his usefulness as a protector. I wondered if Dwalia saw that. On the other side of me, Vindelire slumped. He had an odd face, sometimes boyish, and at other times the face of a disappointed old man. It had fallen into dismal folds today as he stared at the waves.
"So far from home,"
he said woefully.
"Tell me of our destination, brother."
Being asked to speak always flattered him. I had become the avid listener, never correcting or silencing him. "What will it be like when we arrive there?"
"Oh,"
he breathed out long, as if he did not know where to begin.
"It depends on where we land. We may dock in deep water on the other side of the island. We may land in Cecil, or perhaps Crupton. Dwalia will be known there. I hope for a night in a comfortable inn and a good meal. Lamb with mint, perhaps. I like lamb. And a warm, dry room."
He paused as if already savouring those simple pleasures.
"She may hire a carriage to take us to Clary's. I hope she does not want to ride there on horseback. A horse's back has never fit my bottom well."
I nodded sympathetically.
"And we will go to Clary's. Perhaps we may dock there. It will depend on what sort of a ship we can find. It will be a full summer when we arrive. Hot for you, little northern thing that you are. Nice for me. I will welcome the sun baking the aches out of my joints. Clary's gleams white on a sunny day. Some of it is built of ancient bone, and other parts are white stone."
"Bone? That sounds frightening."
"Does it? Not to me. Worked bone can be lovely. When we get there, we will wait for low tide to bear the causeway and then cross to our island sanctuary. Surely you have heard of it. The tops of the watchtowers are shaped like the skulls of ancient monsters. At night, the torches inside make the eyes gleam with orange light, and they appear to be looking out in all directions. It is imposing and powerful.
He stopped and scratched his wet cheek. Rain dripped from his chin. Then he leaned closer and lowered his voice to impart an important secret to me.
The furniture in the four towers is made from dragon's bones. Symph has a set of drinking cups carved from dragon's teeth and lined with silver. They are very old, passed down from Symph to Symph through the generations.
Symph to Symph? He lifted his pale brows.
The woman in the north tower is always called Symph.
How can you not know these things?
I was taught them when I was very young. Clarys is the heart of the world, and the heartbeat of the world must always be steady.